Okay, I have 9 o'clock on my computer, so we will begin. We finished up last class with Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. There's actually 4 complete classes on the website for download. We now are moving into, as I said last time, leaving 19th century Italy and moving into Lithuania, early 20th century America, to deal with Rabbi Yaakov David Wolofsky, the Ridbaz. But before we deal with him, let me just respond to some questions which I've been asked, as always. A number of semesters ago, I think it was a number of semesters ago, I made a comment that I don't even think that the Chafetz Chaim had smicha. So someone asked me for proof of that. And I don't know if I should be thankful or not, but when I get questions like that, it usually takes me a long time to find the answer, but I did find the answer. If you look in, there's a biography of the Chafetz Chaim written by, his name is Yashar, Y-O-S-H-R or E-R. I think it was even published in English by Art Scroll. And in the introduction there, it explains that when the Chafetz Chaim wanted to travel to the Agudas Yisrael Convention in 1923, he needed to get a passport, to want to get a picture taken. So he, they talk about how he was able to convince the government to allow him to get a passport, the Polish government to give him a passport without his picture being taken. Now, that is significant for another reason, in that we only have 2 pictures that I know of. There only are 2 pictures of Chafetz Chaim. Actually, 3 pictures I know of the Chafetz Chaim. And one of them is the famous one, the one that used to be on Machberetz, and it's the famous picture of the Chafetz Chaim. You've all seen the picture. Not on Machberetz, that's the Rambam's picture. However, this picture of the Chafetz Chaim, the famous one, is not a picture of the Chafetz Chaim at all. How do I know that? Well, because the Chafetz Chaim's own daughter said about this picture that it's a shiny yid, it's a good-looking Jew, but it's not my father. In fact, if anyone's interested, there was an article on this very topic in a now-defunct journal, Hasidic Historical Review, and was authored by Shaul Shimon Deutsch, who goes by the title of the Rebbe of Lyozhno. He's the one who wrote the biographies of Lubavitch Rebbe, and he has a whole article there on the pictures of the Chafetz Chaim. The only 2 pictures I know of the Chafetz Chaim are one where all you see is his face, and another one where he's sitting in front of his house with one of his sons. That's quite a famous picture, except there's 2 versions of it. In one of the versions, you have a woman, probably the Rebbetzin, standing, actually 2 women, one the Rebbetzin and another woman standing behind him. And in recent publications of this photo, the women have been cut out. They've been censored out, because I guess they want people to think that the Chafetz Chaim wouldn't allow his wife to stay anywhere near him. Maybe keep her locked up in somewhere. I don't know. And then it says that in this introduction to the biography that it lists your profession, and he wrote rabbi, and they insisted that he, this is 1923, that he give them proof that he's a rabbi. So it's only in 1923. He dies in 1933. So this is the last decade of his life after he's already written all of his works. Only then does he go to Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski in Vilna and a request from Chaim Moser Grudzinski in Vilna to send him a smicha. So Chafetz Chaim received his smicha at the age, I think he's 81 then, or maybe 83, in the year 1923. First thing down. Someone asked me to clarify what I said last week about Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Remember, I mentioned that he cited the response of the Rush. Rush said that you have a man, let's say, who's married to this woman, and the woman has children, and she dies. Okay, so the property goes to the husband and the children. But if she has no children, according to the Torah, the man gets all the property that she brought into the marriage. But Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan says that this goes against natural rights, and therefore, that's why there was a decree, an ordinance in Spain, that they, in Toledo, that they would... the Torah says that half of the woman's property goes to the husband and half goes back to her family. Now, this is found in the response of the Tshuva of the Rush. You can see this in number 54, and it goes through the whole three. which is no different really than the decrees we saw when we dealt with Morocco. There is a Torah law, but the rabbis, for whatever reason, assume that it's not fitting for their era, and therefore they make a decree that half of the woman's property go back to her family, where she came from. And the decree actually says, because they don't want, let me find the language here, I don't want to take the time to find the exact language, the idea being that this woman comes into the marriage with it, and now she's gone and she has no children, should the husband get everything? However, the Rush doesn't say anything about any notion of natural right, and I mentioned last class the problem with this type of language. Because if it's natural right, then why did the Torah institute this? I think it makes much more sense to assume that if you ask the Rush, or the rabbis who made this decree, how they can, I wouldn't say go against the Torah, but update the Torah, alter what the Torah is, they would respond, I'm certain, that in the circumstances we live in today, this is our role as rabbis, make adjustments to the Torah, because that's what the job of rabbis, that's what Chazal did, that's what we do. But not to say, as Chazan says, that this is actually a natural right. I found that problematic. Two more things. If any of you read Ma'ariv, you'll find a very interesting article last week. It relates to things we did. In fact, it relates to a lecture I gave on Shabbos. I was in Memphis on Rav Herzog, but we did Rav Herzog in this class. The Justice Minister, Yaakov Ne'eman, spoke about how it's important to make he's really speaking about civil law, I believe, in accordance with halacha. So there's an article in Ma'ariv by Batya Kahana Dror, and she asks a good question. She says, which Jewish law are we referring to, Kavod Hasar? Are we referring to the Jewish law of the current Batei Din that believe in canceling divorces after they're given? Are we talking about the Jewish law as practiced by current Beit Din, that the Batei Din, that women have no rights? Or are we talking about Jewish law of the sort of Rav Herzog? And she goes on to say that we have to think back to the time of Rav Herzog and et cetera, et cetera, and how the Batei Din today have moved far away from the religious Zionist ideal as expressed by Rav Herzog. I think that is quite relevant to what we've been doing. One more thing. I think some of you, actually two more things. Some of you might find this interesting. We spoke about Rav Avadya Yosef. This is what he said in the summer. In September. I never got around to it till now, though. He spoke about when the Messianic era arrives, and he says as follows. We cannot decide until Mashiach comes for everyone to do the same. Only Mashiach will do it. He will tell them, as the Ashkenazim, what do you say? Burichatu? Say Baruch Atah. And when he says it, they won't be able to disagree. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov will arise. What will they say? They were Chalabim. They were from Aleppo. That is, they were from that part of the world, the Sephardic world. They didn't say Burichatu. They said Baruch Atah. They'll say the Ashkenazim, Baruch Atah, and all Ashkenazim will repent. So that's, I think, quite interesting. Okay, and finally, this relates to the semester before, we spoke about the notion of concubinage, that a man would live with a wife without being married. I mentioned that this was we saw this with Rav Mesas, actually, last semester. He didn't see any problem with it. And I spoke about the idea, he says, as long as the woman is a mikvah, and someone asked me, is it permitted for her to do that without being married? And I said, of course. The rabbis won't publicly say so, and they might say that in their town you can't, but I said, I find it hard to believe that if anyone asked the rabbi what to do if you're in that situation, that he wouldn't say to go to the mikvah. And over the summer, this volume appeared. Responds a Dibrot Eliyahu. This is by Rav Eliyahu Abergel. He's a Dayan in Jerusalem, a leading Moroccan authority, and in number 19, he responds to questions of his son, Elchanan. His son was a rabbi in Orlando. I looked on the internet before, he's in Orlando. He now lives in Philadelphia, but he serves as a rabbi in New York. I'm not sure how he does that. And he asked his father this question. He had people in his community who are just living together, should they go to the mikvah? And He replies, you can't say this publicly because then people marry, that sort of thing. But if you can speak to them quietly and you can't, and they're going to do this anyway, you can't convince them to get married, certainly tell them to do that. Just as interesting, I think, is the very next stanza. Again, to his son, who's Moritz Sedek of Orlando. He was asked about riding a bicycle on Shabbos, and he concludes that's forbidden. But then he asks, well, because people, let's say, live far from Shul, he says, well, don't ride a bicycle. He says, use roller skates, roller blades. Now, this is a question. I am certain that if you ask any rabbi in your town, they would say it's absolutely forbidden to use roller blades, although it's hard for them to explain why. Because we all push baby carriages and things like that. And he explains why there's no problem with roller blades. He quotes Rabbi Ben Sion Abba Shaul, a big Sephardic authority, who also says it's no problem riding roller blades. And I never used them, but I once had to walk 4 miles when I lived in Cambridge. I read the Torah, and if I would have used roller blades, I thought of using them, but I decided that everyone would think there's a problem with it. You could see a case where someone is becoming religious and they live very far from Shul, that giving, 3 miles, 4 miles away, that you could tell them to use roller blades. I don't know. That's an interesting psak. I could send it to you if anyone's interested. Okay. Let us move on now. Let us begin. I thought I saw Dov Weinstein typing something. I guess not. Still is typing, so we are dealing with Rav Yaakov Dublin Wolofsky. Get him on the screen here again. He is a fascinating figure. He is one of the first great rabbis to come to America. And he really makes waves here. He becomes very well known for a stand against Rav Kook, as we'll see in the Shemitah controversy, as well as for his monumental commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud. In fact, he was considered the world's expert on the Jerusalem Talmud in an era where very few people were studying this. Okay, so Eva, that's interesting you asked. The question is, did they ask the Rav or not? I know that in the places that most of us live, if you ask the rabbi, they'll say no. I think maybe they'll fall back that it's Uvda D'chol, which means that it's a weekday practice, although today, not many people seem to rollerblade anymore like they used to. And what does that mean, a weekday practice? I guess the posek would have to weigh if it's a weekday practice. That's not the reason they give for not riding a bicycle. There are Syrians to this day who do ride a bicycle because of the Ben Ish Chai. But you could see how that could come in handy, that for certain ride a bicycle. And I know that kids riding a tricycle, I think the standard psak of rabbis is there's no problem with kids riding a tricycle. If kids on Shabbos want to play, I've never heard any problem if kids want to play on a skateboard. A bicycle, that's a different issue because it could easily break and things like that. I just mention it because it's the very next response, and I thought it's really interesting, and I wonder if a rabbi who's in America, who actually lives in America, if he ever would have given that answer. But Rabbi Abergel, living in Jerusalem, he's asked this question. He can look at it just purely halachically. I've never seen anyone rollerblading in Jerusalem, so it's not really such an issue there. Kids in LA use scooters. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, thank you, Eva. As I said, not many study the Jerusalem Talmud. It's only been relatively recently that you now have a Daf Yomi from the Ger Rebbe on the Jerusalem Talmud, and intensive, but the Ritzbaz, Rav Yaakov David Wolofsky, was an intensive student of it, as we'll see. In fact, it's interesting that the very first Talmud printed in the United States was Rav Eliezer Alperstein's edition and commentary of Tractate Bikuri, published in Chicago in 1887. I believe you can find it on HebrewBooks.org. Alperstein was an early teacher at Shivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, then he moves to Chicago. And he published two editions of this, and the first one was 1887. A Jerusalem Talmud is what he published. Much like the Ritzbaz, he had big problems in Chicago also. In the first edition of this commentary of Talmud, in the introduction, he praises his congregation. However, by the time you get to the second edition, which I think is 6 or 7 years later, he refers to his congregants as wild boars. And I guess he assumes that they couldn't read the Hebrew, so he could say that. There was another great American Rav who was an expert on the Jerusalem Talmud. So we have Albert Stein, you have the Ritvaz, Rabbi Sivitz of Pittsburgh wrote commentaries on the Jerusalem Talmud. And in a previous class, when we dealt with her first side, we spoke about Rav Dichus, of David Dichus's grandfather, the rabbi of Leeds, who died in, I think, 1937. He was regarded as the leading expert of the Jerusalem Talmud of his time. Other than those rabbis, I don't really know anyone who stands out. Well, obviously, Lieberman was an expert on the Jerusalem Talmud, but he was writing, and he wrote Yerushalmi Kishuto, but he was writing more of a combination of academic and traditional, not a purely traditional. But yes, Lieberman said something very interesting. He said that he came to Jerusalem, he still only knew about traditional writings, and he saw a copy of Zachariah Frankel, who also was an expert on the Jerusalem Talmud. I don't know if Hebrew Books has his commentary. Zachariah Frankel wrote a commentary on Brachot, Demai, and Peah of the Jerusalem Talmud. And I have no doubt that Art Scroll was using his commentary. I know for a fact that Art Scroll is using Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin is also a bit of an expert on the Jerusalem Talmud. All these religious Zionist rabbis became experts on the Jerusalem Talmud as well, Rav Cook, because they thought that we're returning to the land of Israel, we should study it. But I know someone who works at Art Scroll, and he told me that they have Rav Gorin's Perush. They have a copy of it because it's been out of print for many years. Obviously, they'll never quote him, but many of you probably know that Art Scroll is now engaged in translation of the entire Jerusalem Talmud. I think it's interesting. The entire Shulchan Aruch has not yet been translated. So we're translating Jerusalem Talmud when we still haven't translated the Shulchan Aruch. I'm assuming that Art Scroll will go on to the Rambam maybe next, or the Shulchan Aruch. But Lieberman said he saw Frankel's Mavol Yerushalmi. Frankel has an introduction to Yerushalmi, and he couldn't understand. What do you need an introduction for? And it's reading that book that got him into the study of Yerushalmi in a critical sense. Well, these people I mentioned, Sivitz, who's from your town, Rabbi Hirsch and others, they viewed the Yerushalmi as from a Bavli-centric view. Rav Cook, however, had this idea that the Yerushalmi preserves an Eretz Yisrael-type Torah, and Rav Gorin, as we spoke about, he saw similarly that now we need to return to the Yerushalmi. Just to give one example, Rav Gorin pointed out that although the Bavli has some negative comments about converts and how we should push them away, converts are difficult for Israel, the Jerusalem Talmud has no such comment, and therefore we can rely on the Jerusalem Talmud in the land of Israel, and in this quasi or proto-messianic era, we have to turn once again to the Jerusalem Talmud. It has to do with this expression, how the Babylonian Talmud, Babylonia is in darkness, and that refers to the Babylonian Talmud. You could see that in a negative way or a positive way, but Rav Cook and Rav Gorin and others, Rabbi David Bar Chaim that we spoke about in Israel today, they're very much into reviving the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud doesn't have the same superstitions as the Babylonian Talmud, and so there are differences. Yes, so there are other commentaries. Rav Chaim Konevsky has a very clear and simple comment. Not just him, there was a commentary written by a rabbi who was stuck inside the Soviet Union. I think he wrote on the entire Jerusalem Talmud. It was smuggled out in the 1960s, and they published, I think, about 15 volumes by now. Certainly about 10 volumes. I studied most of Yerushalmi Brachos with his commentary. I forget. His name is Krushelov or something like that. I forget his exact name. But that's not the only one, Ovadia. There's about two other commentaries on the Jerusalem Talmud. In the journal Hakira, of I think 3 or 4 issues ago, one of the editors of it, got his name now. He's published a little book on the Jerusalem Talmud also. He wrote a review of all three of these commentaries, because there is today in the land of Israel a revival of interest in the Yerushalmi. Once I was studying Bavli, even with Rabbi Hirsch, who's on here now, we studied a little Yerushalmi together, but yes, Seltzer. Thank you, Jonathan. And he wrote a nice little book on the Yerushalmi. But I once was studying Bavli parallel to Yerushalmi, and it was really fascinating. This was, I said I'd do this after I reread The Chosen. If you recall the book The Chosen, really about David Weiss HaLivni, he points out how certain problems are not a problem if you read the Yerushalmi. So I started studying them parallel, and it's true. You'll find certain problems that the Bavli thinks are problems, and they come up with four solutions. Yerushalmi explains matters much more simply, I'm sure vice versa as well, but a very different approach in many areas. In our yeshivas, we don't do that, but in many places, the Rambam adopts the Yerushalmi, the Gra. Rabbi Baruch Haim points us out that the Vilna Gaon points out that Rambam in many places follows the Yerushalmi. We're still not sure why, what his rule is. There's been some attempts. Professor Brody recently attempted to formulate some rules as to when the Rambam follows the Yerushalmi. The Rambam wrote a book, Hilchot Yerushalmi, in which he called the halachos out of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Shaul Lieberman edited this. And I don't think anyone's been able to explain why. It's sort of like a riff on the Yerushalmi, why the Rambam would write a riff on the Yerushalmi. Why do we need the laws of the Yerushalmi unless you assume that he sees the laws in the Yerushalmi as much more significant than what most people view them as. Look, in the traditional halachic works, the Yerushalmi is not really ever quoted and not used as halacha unless there's nothing in the Bavli. The Bavli is ambiguous, but to say that you're going to overrule the Bavli based on the Yerushalmi, that's different. So I can tell you why today there's a revival of interest in the Yerushalmi with the return of Israel, etc. Why these rabbis were interested in the Yerushalmi, you can read their introductions. They'll say things like, no one studies these works. That's, if I recall correctly, that's the justifications they give. Yes, that's the one. Ovadia. Yeah, that's what is often given the explanation. Thank you, Rabbi Hirsch. Let's move on. Let's start with the biography. Why is he known, first of all, as Ridbaz? Some people might confuse him with Rav David ben Zimra, the Radbaz, who lived in 16th century Egypt. This is the Ridbaz, Rav Yaakov David ben Zev Wilovsky. Born in Russia in 1845, and like all great sages, recognizes a genius in his youth, with all sorts of stories told about him. In 1868, he becomes Rav of a small Russian town named Izbolin, and then he's now 23 years old. He had been able to study for a number of years before assuming the Rabbanus, because, like is often the case, his father-in-law supported him. At the age of 29, he published his first book, Migdal David. It's not really a significant work in the sense that it's studied anymore today, but it must have impressed people at the time, because shortly after this, he becomes Rav of the city of Bobruisk, which is a significant city in Russia, sized for large town, small city. They had a branch of Chabad Hasidus there. Bobruiskers come from Bobruisk. The last Bobruisker Rebbe died in 1923, Stegen Shemaria Noach Schneerson, and after that, most of the Bobruiskers joined with mainstream Chabad Lubavitch. But Rav Zevin, for example, was a Bobruisker. And there was other important figures who were in Bobruisk. From Bobruisk, he goes to Vilna in 1881, where he was a dayan and also the official magid of the city. Rav Yaakov Yosef later would have this role, official magid, that is, preacher. He stays there only a short time, and in 1883 moves out to a small community. There was money problems and all sorts of issues he had there. And in 1887, he goes to Wilkomir, Poland, which is part of the Russian Empire, but in Poland, which is a bigger community. But he couldn't stay long. There was a government rule that the rabbi had to speak Polish. So therefore he returned to Russia and becomes rabbi of the city of Slutsk. Now in Russia there was also a rule that every community rabbi had to know Russian. However, in Russia, and in Poland also, if they could afford it, but in Russia, in the big cities especially, they had two rabbis. The community, if they could afford it, they'd have the official rabbi, the crown rabbi, who was Russian, and his job was simply to fill out the births and deaths and represent the Jews before the government. And then there was an unofficial rabbi, not recognized by the government, but who was the rav of the city, supported by the Jews. If you're a smaller town and you couldn't afford to have two rabbis, you would want to get one rabbi who could be both a traditional rabbi, a posek, and also the crown rabbi, but most Russian rabbis couldn't even read Russian. However, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, he served as both crown rabbi and spiritual rabbi. Rav Eliel Klatskin, who was one of the Gedolei Yisrael, he also served. And there were a number of leading sages when they saw it was important, they weren't, basically all you needed was, I think, a second or third grade education. Just be able to do basic math and reading and to speak Russian. So many of them, as a way of ensuring their parnasa, because a small town could not afford to employ both a spiritual rabbi and a crown rabbi, they learned Russian. And often a town would take someone who wasn't a very learned person, even though he had been in the yeshiva just a few years, but he wasn't that learned, but at least he knew Russian. And the real Talmid Chachamim were unable to get positions because they couldn't perform the perfunctory role that every rabbi today in England and France and America, they know it because they've taken basic secular education. Even if they dropped out in eighth grade or sixth grade, they could be able to do that. So here's Rav of Slutsk. While in Slutsk, a number of students come to study with him. He opens up a small yeshiva there. Just to give you an example of some of the future Gedolei Yisrael who study with him. This is Zalman Meltzer. Rav Reuven Katz, the Degel Reuven, later rabbi in Hoboken, New Jersey. Following that, in Petach Tikva, chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. Rav Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva. And Rav Joseph Konvitz, who later becomes Ridbaz's son-in-law. He joins him in Tzfat in Israel. Konvitz's son was Professor Milton Konvitz, who was an authority on constitutional and labor law. And Milton Konvitz's middle name is actually Ridbaz. He spelled it R-I-D-W-A-S. Konvitz, who was the person also who instituted the first one to bring kosher food to Cornell University, where he was for so long. Those of you who have the book of Rabbi Soloveitchik's letters that came out a couple of years ago, responds from Rabbi Soloveitchik on use of an interfaith chapel at Cornell University, is addressed to Professor Milton Konvitz. Joseph Konvitz, his father, becomes the rabbi in Newark, New Jersey. I shouldn't say the rabbi. He becomes a rabbi in Newark, New Jersey, because, as we'll see, he too, we won't see, because we're not going to deal with Rabbi Konvitz, but is involved in a great deal of machlokes in Newark. Now, the Ritzbaz has a small yeshiva. As I mentioned, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was one of the people who came there. Rav Isser Zalman had been saying a shiur already in Slobodka. He was sent by the Altar of Slobodka to come to the Ritzbaz, and he was the leader of the students who came. He's only 26 years old when he comes, and the Ritzbaz asks him to take over the Ritzbaz's yeshiva. The Ritzbaz wants to travel, as I'll speak about, and raise money and do other things, so he asks Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer to take over his yeshiva. When the Ritzbaz leaves Slutsk, a few years after this, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer takes over. Not only he's not only Rosh Yeshiva now, he also takes over as Rav of the city of Slutsk. The yeshiva later moves to Kletsk. And when Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer moves to the land of Israel, the yeshiva is taken over by Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's son-in-law. So the truth is, although if you go to Lakewood, I don't know if they'll know this, the Ritzbaz is the founder of the Lakewood yeshiva. It's his yeshiva that Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer later takes over because the Ritzbaz asks him to. And then this moves to Kletsk, and Rav Aaron Cutler takes over this yeshiva, and then that moves to America and is reestablished in Lakewood. So the founder of the Lakewood yeshiva is really the Ritzbaz Rav of Slutsk. While in Slutsk, he's devoting himself to the Jerusalem Talmud. And in 1889, he publishes the first volume of his edition of the Jerusalem Talmud, together with his commentary. And in fact, this today is the standard commentary. Go into Sfarim stores today and you buy an edition of the Jerusalem Talmud, it will come with the Ridbaz's comments. He was fortunate in that he had an edition of the Order of Zeraim, the first order of the Talmud, which had notes of the Vilna Gaon. How did he get the money to publish this? It's very expensive to publish an edition of the Jerusalem Talmud. He traveled throughout Western Europe to raise the funds. And even though he was able to publish the Jerusalem Talmud, it cost him so much that he had to even go into debt. So how to raise the money? Well, he continues traveling, first through Europe. Goes to Paris, where Rav Herzog's father is. He meets the Herzog family. Later, he actually, in a return trip, he gives Rav Herzog smicha. Rav Herzog became very attached to him. Rav Herzog's oldest son was Yaakov, he named him Yaakov David, Jacob David Herzog. That's the son who was ambassador to Canada and then to Switzerland. not the official, to one of the UN offices in Switzerland, and was appointed chief rabbi of England before passing away. I think it was 51 years, 1971. So that's Rav Herzog's son. He is broke. The Ritvaz is broke, and in 1900 he decides to go to the Golden Medina, because that's where the money is. Everyone's coming to America to raise money, or to live to make money, so he comes there. And he's quite a character. He comes to America, coming to America to raise money, and he rebukes the people for coming to this treif land, and this is a quote, where even the stones are impure. I'm not sure what such a rebuke was supposed to accomplish. It's not like they were going to return back to Europe. Chafetz Chaim actually said that if he was not so old, he would have come to minister to the people for here. Yet the Chafetz Chaim also urged the people. In one of his books that was directed to people coming to America, he urges them, for the sake of their children, to return back to Europe. Although he must have known this never would have happened. But my grandmother, her mother brought back two of her brothers. This is the early part of the 20th century. The first years of the 20th century, they weren't happy with any of the education here. So she left her husband and family and went back to Europe with two of the sons. I believe she did this twice, once each for a year with one of the sons, so that he could have an education in Europe, in Russia. While in the United States, the Ritvaz is asked to become chief rabbi of New York. Jacob Joseph, in 1900, Jacob Joseph is bedridden. He's very, basically bedridden. He soon becomes completely bedridden. He might even be completely bedridden at this time. In any event, he's not functioning really as the chief rabbi in any sense. He's quite ill. However, the Ritvaz refuses and returns to Europe. He was only in America a few months. Yet in 1903, he comes to America again. This time to sell his books and to raise money so that he can finally move to the land of Israel. He was a great lover of the land of Israel and wanted to settle there. He had no intention of settling in America permanently. However, if things went well in America, it's obviously possible that he would have stayed permanently. There are many other great rabbis who came to America, thinking it would only be for a year or two, ended up staying here permanently, or at least until they retired. There's numerous stories like this. Not too long ago, I was speaking to one of Arye Levine's grandchildren, Benji Levine. I think some of you might know him, and he told me his father becomes rabbi in Jersey City. He comes to America just again for a couple of years. He ends up staying for 30-some years till he retires back in the land of his son was rabbi of the synagogue in Lower Merion, Philadelphia, many years. That's Benji Levine's brother. What does he do? Well, he accepts a position in Chicago. And his plan is to stay for a little while, make enough money. In fact, he even puts it in his contract that the people in Chicago agree to provide him with a pension, that when he retires, he'll be able to support himself in the land of Israel. This happens in 1903, and he's appointed chief rabbi of Chicago. That doesn't mean everyone accepted him. Far from it. What it means is that a number of shuls came together, gave him the title Rav HaKolel, same title that Yaakov Yosef had. We speak of Rabbi Jacob Joseph as chief rabbi of New York. Well, it was actually the Russian shuls, the Litvaks, and the Russians, they appointed him chief rabbi. There was another rabbi who was regarded as the Rav of the Polish Jews. His name was Siegel, and he's the one that put up the first Erev in New York. He regarded himself as Rav HaKolel. Then there was another one named Witterwitz, who was a big opponent to Yaakov Yosef. He's the one, the famous story, he had a sign that said, Chief Rabbi, and he was asked, well, who made you Chief Rabbi? And he said, the sign maker. He was actually a Chabad Rav. So when you say Rav HaKolel, Jacob Joseph is the Chief Rabbi, yes, a number of synagogues got together and they called him Chief Rabbi. But it's nothing official, like in England or in the state of Israel, which is government recognized. By the same token, the Ritvaz was known as Rav HaKolel, chief rabbi. Many rabbis were known as rabbis of cities. What does this mean? Even in Scranton, where I teach, had a rabbi, Guterman. He's known as the Rav of the city. There were maybe five synagogues, and he's the rabbi of all them. He goes synagogue to synagogue. Every Shabbat is a different synagogue. Because in those days, 100 years ago, rabbis weren't really paid a salary. Yaakov Yosef was, and the Radvaz was paid a salary, but the typical rabbi was not. And even people like the Radvaz, I don't know how much of a salary they were being paid. They made their money at, let's say, Hanukkah time. People would give them Hanukkah geld. They did weddings. They did funerals. They made money from selling the chametz. So if you had, let's say, five shuls, you sold a lot of chametz. You made a lot more money than so if you only had one shul. So every rabbi wanted to have a lot of shuls under him so that he can make his money this way. It's not like they were given a straight salary. Now, Agudas HaRabbanim was formed shortly after the death of Rav Yaakov Yosef, in fact, immediately after the death of Rav Yaakov Yosef, and at their second convention in 1903, they proclaim, this is right after Ridbaz comes to America, they proclaim him as Zakein HaRabbanim, Zakein HaRabbanim in America, that is, the elder rabbi in America. There were great rabbis in America, huge Talmidei Chachamim, but the Ridbaz was regarded as special. Genius, this author of the Commentary on Jerusalem Talmud, and all of the great rabbis in America associated with Agudas HaRabbanim, which is an institution we'll speak about, proclaimed him as their head, their leader, the eminent rabbi in America. What was Agudas HaRabbanim? The European rabbis who came to America formed an organization which became quite powerful during World War II. They're the ones that called this great march on Washington, D.C. during World War II. There's videos of it. They ended up dying out in the 1960s and 70s because they didn't have secular educations. They were the Yiddish-speaking rabbis. But in the early part of the 20th century, it basically is a Russian and Litvish organization. Not really a Hasidic. Hasidic rabbis were not really part of it. It was the traditional Lithuanian and Russian rabbis, and it was actually Mizrahi. Almost all the rabbis in America until World War II were Mizrahi rabbis, but very big Talmidei Chachamim, including Gedolei Yisrael. But the Agudas HaRabbanim don't just declare Ridbaz chief rabbi. They don't just declare him elder rabbi in America. They go further. And in doing this, they put themselves in the midst of a great dispute. They state that they will not accept any hechsher, any hashkacha, from Chicago unless the Ridbaz approves of it. Now, the Ridbaz coming to Chicago wanted to deal with education, the Talmud Torahs. He put a lot of effort into, because the synagogues he was involved with were also had Talmud Torahs, which they helped establish, and this was the only Jewish education for kids. They went to the public schools, they also went to the Talmud Torah. He also wanted to establish a yeshiva, but the first thing he had to do, even before dealing with education, and what would really entangle him for the rest of his time in America, was with kashrus, which had many, many problems. Now, since I'm going to deal with kashrus for a little while here, we're going to get back to kashrus when we deal with Enkin. Let me just tell you everyone a joke. I think you'll appreciate that Teddy, who I believe is listening to us now, sent me. We're in Hanukkah, and everyone has the famous question. If a miracle is for 7 days, they found the oil is enough for one day, and the miracle is for 7 days, everyone asked the question, well, why don't we light the candle for 7 days? Because the first day was no big deal. Obviously, had the oil. So there's many, many answers, ranging from the obvious that, well, the first day is the miracle of finding it. That in itself is a significant thing, finding the oil. And there's numerous answers, complicated answers. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik has a famous answer. There's a book which has, I don't know, maybe one of the Yodea Sefer online can tell me. I think it's over 150 different answers to this problem. But here is the newest answer sent by Teddy that was stated by Rav Mordechai Hager, or Hager, I don't know him. What was the nace on the first day of Hanukkah? We know the nace on the seven last days of Hanukkah is that the oil burnt. The miracle on the first day of Hanukkah, and why we have to celebrate an additional day, 8 days, is that everyone accepted the kashrus of the oil. No one complained and said, no, we don't accept this olive oil. It's not really kosher. So that in and of itself is a miracle that you can get everyone to agree to a hashkacha. I tell you that it's not a joke. You look around, hashkachas, even the most reliable hashkacha, you can have people say it's not reliable. I was in Baltimore a few weeks ago, and they regard as the most reliable hashkacha, the Star K, Rabbi Heinemann. Well, I can tell you the OU does not regard this as the most reliable. In fact, the Star K has put hashkacha on things that the OU says you can't even eat. And Ramosha Sternbach says you can't eat anything of the Star K, and you have people just the opposite say about the OU. So this has always been a problem. Ner Lameya, Rabbi Yosef Engel. Thank you, Avadia. But there's a new one, a new Ner Lameya, I think, published by Rabbi Seltzer, S-E-L, the same Seltzer, I think, that we mentioned before, if I'm not mistaken. A new one with 1,000, very good. So what was the problem in Chicago with kashrus? Well, there was a Rav. His name was Shimon Tzvi Albom, A-L-B-O-M. I don't know if any of you have heard of him, but he was a mainstay, a fixture of Orthodoxy in Chicago before the Ritvaz came and for a good 20-some years after the Ritvaz was gone. His brother was the last Rav of St. Petersburg, Leningrad. And I believe it was his brother published a sefer, maybe it was 1920, if I'm not mistaken. It was the last, might have been the last, or 20, no, it was later than 1920, the last Torah book published in the Soviet Union. I'm going to deal with this in a Sfarim blog post, an upcoming one, because I dealt a lot with Albom. He had another brother who was a big Rav, and Albom himself was a great Talmid Chacham. I don't think anyone could say that he was on the level of the Ritzpaz, but he was a fine Talmud Chacham, greatly respected by rabbis in Europe. You can see some of the letters in the book he published. And here the Ritvaz comes into town and takes over. Let's not forget, Albom was giving hashgacha four, I believe it was four slaughterhouses there. He was giving, in fact, he was giving hashgacha to all the, I think there were only four slaughterhouses. He was giving hashgacha to all these. He was the final authority on kashrus. And this is significant, he was doing it for free, which is very unusual. When you think about kashrus, everyone wants to make money off it, and I don't blame them. That's, you know, that's their parnassa. And that explains, by the way, a lot of why there's such machokas and disputes in kashrus. Because, what do you make of it? You have two great rabbis. Each of them are Talmid Chachamim, and each accuses the other of being completely dishonest. And lying about kashrus supervision and all that. And from us on the outside here, lay people, what are we supposed to make of this? Each of these are great rabbis, and these great rabbis think the worst of the other person. I have no doubt that subconsciously they're led to this because of money. I have enough respect for a lot of these rabbis. I don't think it's consciously that they, I don't believe they would consciously destroy the reputation of another rabbi and say things about him that aren't true just to make money. However, since they are in a struggle for money, especially in the early part of the century, when this was really, this was a starvation or a job, they really needed this. When you're in such a dispute and you're literally fighting for your livelihood, fighting to put bread on the table, you are more apt subconsciously to believe all sorts of negative things about your opponents. That's the only way I can explain how great rabbis, the ones we're going to speak about right now, could say such terrible things about other great rabbis. I have, look, there's issues of kavod as well, but normally it's been issues of money. And don't just think it's New York. The last couple of weeks I finished this book. Rabbis and their communities. Studies in the Eastern European Orthodox Rabbinate in Montreal. And you could read about the same thing happened in Montreal. Great rabbis fighting against each other, calling each other phonies and frauds. And just like in America, violence as well. One of the rabbis, Shimon Glazer, was beaten up. We had violence in America. One rabbi beating up another rabbi. He had the case I spoke about in the Sfarim blog where Rabbi the Ramaz, Rav Margolios, his wedding, they poisoned the food because of his opponents. We've had stories of gangsters hired, beating up great rabbis, all sorts of terrible things. So as I said last week, if you think the machlokas we have today in kashrus is tough to take, and for Yitzhul Hashem, you should see what it used to be like years ago. So then the Albom supervises the meat. This new man, Ritvaz, comes into town and declares that I'm in charge. And the Agudas Harabanim declares that none of the meat from Chicago is going to be accepted in New York unless it has the Ritvaz's Hashkacha. As far as Albom was concerned, this is a terrible slap in the face. It wasn't a question of his Parnassa. Normally you'd say, Hasagas Kavuo, someone's taking my Parnassa, but he wasn't being paid for it. But he was doing a good job, he thought, and he had many butchers who lined up with him, and also rabbis and others who lined up with him and said, this is a terrible thing. How can you come in and just take over this way? And if you read the contemporary literature, you see that the Ridbaz did not give Albom any kavod. He basically treated him like an ignoramus. Had he given him some kavod and respect, matters wouldn't have gotten out of hand. Now, it's tough for us today to really reconstruct everything that was going on. All we have are the polemics from both sides. But if you read the Ridbaz's stuff, in his mind, Albom was an amaretz, an ignoramus. Again, we've spoken about this also. An ignoramus for the Ridbaz means someone who knows all shas, but doesn't have maybe great insight or can't decide halacha properly. We speak of an ignoramus. We mean someone who can't read Hebrew or doesn't know anything. These people are in a different league. Shaul Lieberman used to sometimes call his students ignoramuses, and they thought it was a big matter of kavod, that if he actually thought it was worth calling you an ignoramus, you must know something, because if you knew nothing, he wouldn't even waste his time on you. That's a typical Lithuanian way of looking at it. Now, if you want to see the Ridbaz's view of what was going on in America at the time, he doesn't mention Albom by name, although he refers to the rabbi, the ignoramus. You can find it in the introduction to a few of his books. First, his responsa, Sheol Teshuvat Ridbaz, and also his Nimuke Ridbaz. He wrote a commentary on Chumash. And they are great, great descriptions of Orthodox life in America. And if you take it with a grain of salt, because Ridbaz had a terrible time here and is very negative on everything that he saw in America, so I think you take it with a grain of salt, but you get a sense over what it was like to be a traditional rabbi coming to America where people are more interested in money and there aren't any yeshivas. Although the Ridbaz does speak about great piety he found in America also, yet he reserves a lot of his anger for the ignoramuses, the rabbis who oppose him, etc. Well, Albom did not take this lying down, not for 1 minute. And he published two volumes called Divrei Emet. Here's the title page of one of them. It was reprinted, for reasons I have no idea why, in Borough Park about 20 years ago. I'm holding a copy. In here, he details the entire dispute with the Ridbaz. He defends himself. He has images here of letters of great rabbis to him supporting him, of testimony given by the various butchers, because Ridbaz had accused him of not being a reliable mashgiach, things of that nature. And he also attacks the Ridbaz terribly. He didn't start it, but, you know, like they say, he might not have started it, but he was going to finish it. And in the end, he was the one left standing. One of the things, he attacks the Ridbaz all throughout. He attacks the Ridbaz for being dishonest, for making up lies about him, saying he's not reliable. Any mashgiach, another mashgiach, says he's not reliable is obviously going to respond in kind, because when you say about a mashgiach, say about a kashrus organization, say, for example, about a Rabbi Ralbag, let's say, that he's not reliable, can't trust his hashgacha, what you're saying is that he's a phony, because he's telling you that it's kosher, and he's putting his reputation on the line, and you're saying, despite that, you can't rely on him. Well, if you can't rely on him and he's a phony, that means he's... What's the worst thing in the world for a rabbi? To tell a rabbi he's a fraud, he's a phony, there can't be anything worse than that. You know, if you tell me you're not going to rely on my hashkacha, who am I? But to tell a rabbi that, so you can see why these rabbis take it personally. We're going to get to the Ridbaz. I'll get to the Ridbaz just a minute, because Rabbi Hirsch, one of the two areas that Albom attacks the Ridbaz is the way he, his methodology and how he attacks the Brisker Derech. So one of the things that Albom pointed out is very interesting. Here's the book. Well, I'm going to show you now a title page of one of the books that Ridbaz published in Chicago, and which attacks Albom. Get the title page of this book. It's the Nimuke Ridbaz al Torah. It's the Ridbaz's commentary on the Torah. They ate Rabbeinu, Maor HaGolah, Sar HaTorah, Tzadik Nisgav, HaMafortzah, Makol Kitzvot Tevel, etc., etc. Albom says, have you ever heard of any rabbi who publishes a book and describes himself in this way on the title page? Look at any other Sfarim. Look at Sfarim today. It's Avad Yosef Moshe Feinstein. They just say, Sheol Teshuv Igra Moshe of Moshe Feinstein. They don't even call themselves rabbi. And here, the Ritvaz, and I, as far as I know, the Ritvaz never responded to this. Some Gedolim are great, and they say they're great. Examples of where Gedolim Yisrael say that I came up with a wonderful explanation, and it was greater than any other explanation offered before, or they say things like, and since I was the most learned person in the city, etc. It's published by this Abraham Shmuel Broda, but it's the Ritvaz's work, and he has to take responsibility for it, what appears on it. He obviously, I assume, maybe not, but the album assumes that he saw what the title page was going to say about him, and he says that how can you take seriously a rabbi who either publishes or allows a book to be published that describes himself in such grandiose terms? That's an egotist, and none of us should have anything to do with him. That's the first thing he picks up on. Then he goes through the Ritvaz and calls attention to all the examples that he thinks are mistakes of the Ritvaz, simple errors. And the Ritvaz actually replied later on, and that's the first thing. But then he attacks him for something else that has nothing to do with America, nothing to do with Kashrus, nothing to do with the Ritvaz's learning, something else entirely. In the introduction to the Ritvaz's responsa, Ritvaz writes as follows. I'm going to read it to you. Actually, this was... I'm not sure if this is what he's referring to or if another piece. Because I see now in my notes, this appears in 1907. Yes, this is. The second volume of Divrei Emet is published in 1912. Listen to what the Ritvaz says in the introduction. The Ritvaz's introductions are great because he really tells you what he thinks about everything. A certain rabbi invented the chemical method of study. Those in the know now refer to it as chemistry, chemia, but many speak of it as logic. This proved to be of great harm to us, for it is a foreign spirit from without that they have brought into the Oral Torah. This is not the Torah delivered to us from Moses, from the mouth of the Omnipresent. This method of study has spread among the yeshiva students who still hold a Gemara in their hands. In other words, there aren't that many yeshiva students left in the world, but among those who still are yeshiva students, this method of study, he's speaking about the Brisker method of study that I'll speak about in a minute, saying this method of study has now conquered the yeshivas. In no way does this type of study bring men to purity. From the day this method spread abroad, this kind of Torah has had no power to protect its students. It's better to have no Rosh Yeshiva than to have one who studies with the chemical method. It's better to have no Rosh Yeshiva than to have a Rosh Yeshiva. What does Dovi Hoffman say? I just was in Memphis this Shabbos, Dovi, and Rabbi Greenblatt went on Aliyah just a couple months ago. He signs himself Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, Rav Umorat Tzedek, Memphis, author of this book and that book. That's different than signing your name as for having a book published calling you Harav HaGaon HaMeforsam. I would like to think that when the book appeared, the Ritvaz was surprised by the title page, maybe pleasantly surprised, I don't know, but that the publisher put it on the title page. That the first time the Ritvaz saw the title page is when the book was actually in print. After all, you know about Rav Avad Yosef. Look at all the books that collect his psakim. He's referred to the most grandiose term. Album doesn't buy it. Album, the Ritvaz is living in Chicago. This is one of his followers who publishes the book. The money was raised, no doubt, by Ritvaz himself. He thinks that it's the Ritvaz. Like I said, I'd like to think differently. In addition to what I just read to you, at the end of his responsa, Beit Ritvaz, he has an ethical will. Ethical will is a genre of writing. There's even you can see it on Google Books, Hebrew ethical wills, translated by Israel Abrahams. Going back to medieval times, you have these ethical wills where rabbis, and they don't have any money to leave for their children, but they leave them an ethical will of how they should lead their lives. You have some famous ones. Yehuda Ibn Tibbon is famous. the Rambam's ethical rule is famous. The problem is it's a forgery. We know it's a forgery. It was published, though. I want to write about this on the Sfarim blog also, because it was written about in the new edition that they just published in Israel. They go into great detail to show why it's not a forgery. And they quote some Gedol Yisrael in Jerusalem, but and they quote them by name, who say that it's not a forgery. And one Gedol Yisrael, who I insert in, is Rav Shlomo Fischer, and the only Gedol Yisrael who has any ability to analyze these matters. They quote this unnamed Gadol as saying, and they quote him before that by name, so I know, I am certain it's referring to him, that it's a forgery. Truth is that Rabbi Aryeh Leib Steinman, who's a great Talmudic scholar, he is not fit to decide whether it's a forgery or not. For this, you need to speak to the people who are experts in the writings of the Rambam, in his terminology, in his language, and et cetera, et cetera. And there's no question that this is a forgery. And if you want to see the evidence, just look in Shaylat's edition of the letters of the Rambam. One of the things in this supposed letter, he praises the Ibn Ezra, he attacks the French sages, France, stuffing their faces, and you know, all sorts of terrible stuff. So he didn't write that. Ibn Kaspi. Another famous ethical will is by Ibn Kaspi. That's where Professor Tversky used to love this line, that Ibn Kaspi tells a story in this ethical will. He's telling his son how important it is to study philosophy and all that. But if you study philosophy, what about Talmud? You're going to miss out on a lot of Talmud. And he says, it's not as important. And he gives an example that one day a spoon of his milchik, or a fleishik spoon, fell into the milchik, so he didn't know what the halacha was, so he went to the Rav, and he asked the Rav, and he's not at all embarrassed by it. You know, the Rav's the technician. If you want to know what the halacha is, you go to the Rav. I'm involved in more important things. That's the study of philosophy. So it's a downplaying of halacha. Much like the Chassidus Rebbe's will later do, the Rav became secondary to the Rebbe. And these ethical wills continued up to modern times. And they still continue. Ridvaz has an ethical will. For some reason, in this edition, which is published in 95, Sadr of Cook edition, they took out the ethical will from the back of the responsa. Why? I have no idea. But in this ethical will, he returns to the criticism of the Brisker method and says as follows. Be careful and keep far away from the new method of study that has in recent years spread through Lithuania and Zamut. Those knowledgeable refer to it as chemistry. Something else he says interesting in this ethical will is that he commands his children not to take a rabbinate in Russia. What is Zamut? Zamut is a region next to Lithuania, although usually Zamut is just described as part of Lithuania. What's going on here? Why is the Ridbaz attacking one of the great Torah scholars of modern times, maybe the greatest Torah scholar of modern times? Chaim Soloveitchik. We're not going to have time to get into this here. I'll just say two more minutes, but in the next class we will go into detail. What is this revolution that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik instituted, brought about? What leads the Ridbaz to assume the defensive, the conservative defensive, to trying to push off this revolution and bring things back to the way they were prior to Rav Chaim? That's what we'll do next class. But let me just go on for two more minutes. Rav Chaim's method is described as follows by his grandson, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics were it not for Rav Chaim's method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, and philosophy. What Rav Soloveitchik is saying is that people today are sophisticated. They're getting advanced degrees in physics and mathematics. Therefore, Rav Chaim's method, sophisticated Torah study, is what keeps people attracted to Torah study. The old approach to Torah study, the old way people did things, which is a more simple approach, focused on Jewish law, which was not conceptual, which was not analytic, that would not be found challenging and attractive by the sophisticated young people today. And therefore, and this is what Rav Soloveitchik sees as the great historical significance of Rav Chaim's method, that it saved Torah for modern times. Now, we will see next class, this doesn't mean that it was invented for this reason. No, they see this as continuing the path of the Rishonim, of the early authorities just expanding upon it. But from a historical perspective, Rabbi Soloveitchik claims that Reb Chaim's method literally saved Torah in modern times because it could compete with the most advanced forms of secular learning. Next class, which actually is the last class of the semester, we'll pick up again, though, in January. We will get into the Brisker method in great detail, and we will also return to the Kashrus Machlokas and what leads the Ridbaz to abandon Chicago. And then he goes to the land of Israel, where once again he's involved in disputes with Hook and others. It is the case that everywhere the Ridbaz went, Machlokas followed him. Talk more about that. Having said that, he still is one of the great sages, and we'll see some fascinating things next week about his time when he comes to the land of Israel and his relationship with Rav Kook. So it's already 10 o'clock now. Again, I want to encourage everyone. We're having a special class, the Nitzel night, December 24th. They're charging for this, but it's the only class of the year that they're charging for, a special class on the practice of not studying Torah Christmas Eve. I encourage everyone to sign up, tell others about it. And now if there's questions, let me... No, Avadia, what do you mean it's merely his opinion? If he says he's Rav and Moritz Tzedek of Memphis, why is that his opinion? That's a fact. He's Rav of Moritz Tzedek of Memphis, and he's the author of Responsa Rivavot Ephraim. So I don't see why that is... see how that is any, you know, any problem with that... Is it any different than if Moshe Feinstein were to sign his things? As I think he does. Nivras Moshe. Rosh Hashiva, Yeshiva Tiferes Yerushalayim. Are you referring to the Derech of Risk? Ah. You make a good point. Obviously, for some people, it's not going to be attractive. It's not attractive to the Ridvaz. It's not going to be attractive to the Marcheshes and others. However, Avadi, we have to explain, though, why this method conquered the yeshivas. It conquered the yeshivas very quickly. Obviously, there was something about it that filled a longing for yeshiva students. Which of Salvage is expressing an opinion, and it is attractive as an opinion, but the historical viewpoint that it filled a need would seem to be illustrated by the way it took off in the yeshiva world. We'll get into more detail next class, and I'll deal with more disputes over the Brisker Derech, opposition to the Brisker Derech, as well as Rabbi Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg's incredible analysis and evaluation of why the Brisker Derech is so important and so valuable, even though it is historically incorrect, even though the Rambam never meant this, yet it still is of great value. Paradoxical? Maybe, but not according to Rabbi Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg. No, but there's two things the Rav is pointing out. First of all, he's speaking primarily, when he gave this talk, this is one of his drushas, he's speaking about his own students. That he could not teach Torah to students today, all of whom get advanced degrees. Well, advanced degrees. His language is, they're trained in the science and mathematics. He could not teach Torah at Yeshiva University without the Brisker method, because he's dealing with students who are advanced. However, corollary to that is, and the Rav pointed this out elsewhere also, is that the method itself is sophisticated. In the early 20th century, all these different, the sciences, the universities, they were all beckoning to Jews. And unless you had a sophisticated method of Torah study to hold on to them, the yeshivas would have emptied out, because the Torah study would have been cold to them, would have been sterile, and the call of the university, of the, you know, the sophistication of the university would have been too much. However, the yeshivas were able to hold on to the students because they were giving them something just as sophisticated. The yeshiva students didn't get tired, didn't get bored of it. And that's the point. Not sure, Avadia, what you can elaborate on that a bit. To Ethan, I can't answer that. It was great. I'll tell you another time how Memphis was. Memphis is a very interesting shul. There was a time when it was, this is a question I was asked, but it was sent to me so the others can't see it, but I'll just say, there was a time that the shul in Memphis was the largest Orthodox shul in the country. That is most members, 1,200. Now they only have about 500, 1,200 families. Now they have 500 families, but still a very big shul, 500 families. There's another shul with 300 families. Both rabbis are named Finkelstein. The shul in Baltimore that I was at 4 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, that's the biggest shul. That has 1,400 families. It's also interesting, the Baron Hirsch shul, in that the rabbi there, this Rabbi Grossman, left after about 25 years. The rabbi who took over the shul, they decided not to go the normal route of YU or anything like that. He was the Rosh Kollel of the Torah Zion Kollel in Memphis. And the community took such a liking to him, and if you meet him, if any of you met him, you'll see what I mean. He is the most likable person you can meet. They hired him. They hired the Rosh Kollel of the Torah Mitzion Kollel to be the Rav of this shul. And he's been there now 5 years as Rosh Kollel and 5 years as Rav, and they love him there. Thank you very much. I'm surprised that Beckhofer actually has a link to Frankel's Peirush. Beckhofer himself, already when he was in Chicago, and I think he still continues, started a Daf Yomi Yerushalmi. So he's a big, great interest in Yerushalmi. There are commentaries in Yerushalmi. Chua Ben Venisti wrote a commentary on Yerushalmi, but there weren't. You have more commentaries on Yerushalmi in the last 30 years than you had in all of Jewish history. The seminary, Dr. Zlotnick published a commentary of Ezra Azkiri wrote a commentary on the Yerushalmi, but it was very uncommon to do commentaries on Yerushalmi. Big question, of course, is how much Rashi used the Yerushalmi. If you look in my Kuntres on Shaul Lieberman, he discusses that in his letters to Solomon Zeitlin there, Rashi's use of the Yerushalmi. Lieberman thinks that Rashi only used Yerushalmi. If there was a problem in the Bavli, he'd check on the Yerushalmi. And anyone who's learned in Yeshiva knows that occasionally Tosfos will cite the Jerusalem Talmud. But it doesn't seem to be at all systematic. And because of this, there are references to a Jerusalem Talmud. I know Dan Rabinowitz dealt with this, but of the order Kudshim. We have orders of Jerusalem Talmud on order of Zeraim, of seeds, which we don't have in the Bavli. Maybe there used to be, or it was lost, or I think most people, maybe there never was. But there does seem to be, according to almost everyone, an order of Kudshim, an order of Yerushalmi of Kudshim. At least it's referred to, unless they're just speaking about Halachic Midrash or something else. And in one of the most notorious forgeries in the late 19th, early 20th century, this man Solomon Friedlander published an entire, I think it's three volumes, of the Yerushalmi Kudshim forged. And not only did he get the great scholar Solomon Buber to buy into it, and he wrote a little commentary, the great Maharsham, Shlomo Mordechai Shvadron, the Poseg Acharon of his day, he bought into it. And just like great academic scholars and traditional scholars bought into it and thought that this forged Yerushalmi was authentic, so too it took both the academic scholars and the traditional scholars to prove a forgery. Right now, Rabbi Baruch Oberlander, the Rav of Chabad Rav of Budapest, is preparing for publication. He's published many articles on the Yerushalmi Kudshim, and he just completed a doctorate on this. It's a whole 350 pages, I think, of including much unpublished material. He published letters, and he really got to the bottom of this whole thing about forgery of the Jerusalem Talmud, the Order of Kudshim, one of the great forgeries of modern times. In the Jewish world. Let's see. Yeah, that's a thank you, Avadia, very much. There are stories about Rav Aaron Cutler calling people that in the Lithuanian world they would call people, apparently they would only call you an Am Aretz if you question of the Hebrew or Machshiv you. If they thought you were worth being called an Am Aretz, because then they would call you. So that's nice. Yeah, it was more accessible. It's almost perhaps you might want to say that Yerushalmi never made it to Europe. Same way that it was, like other Sfarim, never made it to Europe, Babylonia. You have experts on the Yerushalmi, Mr. Zussman and others who dealt with it. I think the reason Art Scroll is translating it is because, first of all, they have this whole institute established. It's a way to make money. Also, don't forget, there are many people there making parnassa. Art Scroll is very strange. Art Scroll is non-profit. And sorry, it's not non-profit. It's a for-profit enterprise. The Masora Foundation is non-profit. But I take that back. I think Art Scroll is technically non-profit. The people who dedicate these books can take a tax deduction, and yet many people, though, are being supported, and the salaries are not low salaries. If you go on GuideStar, which gives you all the salaries of executives in nonprofits, and you plug in Misora, you'll find the salaries of the people running ArtScroll. They're not low salaries. I think so. You have all these people getting Parnassa, and you have people willing to fund it. Why not continue on it? How many people are going to use your in English? I don't know. Steinsaltz is coming out slowly with your Shalmi in Hebrew as well. No, the Rugachever didn't fall for it. And if stories are to be believed, the Rugachever looked at the page for a minute and concluded that it was false. And you know how he concluded it was false? Because, let me see if I remember this exactly. Yes, the only rabbi's name, the Rugachever was this genius. Rugachever one class. He went through a tractate, and there wasn't one rabbi wasn't found in the Babylonian Talmud. In other words, one Maimar, Talmudic discussion, which you couldn't find a parallel. Nothing new. No names, no new ideas, nothing completely new. And therefore, the Rugachever concluded it had to be made up. Rameir Simcha didn't fall for it. That I don't recall. Rameir Don Plotsky didn't fall for it. He wrote a whole volume against it. But as I said, the Marsham fell for it. The Chafetz Chaim fell for it. Chafetz Chaim started wearing, what is it? He started wearing two tears. Was it Rabbeinu Tam's phone he started wearing because of, I forget now exactly, but the Chafetz Chaim fell for it. Gedol Yisroel fell for it. And you had Rabbi Ritter of Holland. He was the academic, and also there was another academic type. When I say academic, these were Rabbanim, but who had academic training, who started writing about it, and as well as others. If you want to get a good discussion of it, the reprint of Rameir Don Plotsky's Sha'alu Shalom Yerushalayim, which is his polemic against Friedlander, in the introduction, Shmuel Sprecher, who's a cardiologist, or a radiologist, actually, in New York, but he's a Talmud Chacham, he published about a 10-page introduction in which he reviews the Friedlander affair, which is reading, if you're interested in more detail, you can go Or Yisroel. Many of them are already on HebrewBooks.org. You can read Rabbi Baruch Oberlander. It's only in Hebrew, though. But his many articles discussing this, he published all the letters between Friedlander and Solomon Schechter. Schechter gave Friedlander money. One of the volumes is actually dedicated to Schechter. Schechter thought that this is one of the great discoveries in modern times, like the Geniza, but after a while, Schechter began to suspect that something wasn't exactly kosher here. Also, the Rav, Rav of Satmar was Rav Yitzchak Klein. That's where Friedlander was living. Eventually, he began to suspect that something was up.
Yeah.
You said the shit in the Masechas Ketanos. That's a good point. No one studies the Masechas Ketanos. I guess one day they'll have to do Tosefta too and everything else. So Sansino translated the Masechas Ketanos. Could be. Friedlander called himself Samach Tet, which he thought meant Sfardi Tahar, which doesn't mean, but that's what people thought it meant. Here was a guy who claimed to have been some Sephardic rabbi from the Middle East who spoke Yiddish and did not have a Spanish accent, but the nail was really put in his coffin. And in Tel Talpio, which was the journal, one of the Rabbanim published an article there explaining who this guy was. In those days, communication wasn't as fast as today, so it took many, many months before these news got out, years even. So the Rav of the city that Friedlander comes from publishes an article revealing to the whole world who he is. And then the Dor Ravi, we spoke with the Dor Ravi, Rav of Kluj, he told another story how Friedlander comes to Kloisenberg and he forges some Kamea, says it's from Jonathan Ivshitz. Maybe we should have I think... Right now we're doing Gedol Yisroel. If Rabbi Kelman wants me to do the scoundrels of history, Shaul Berlin, the forger Shapiro, Firkovich, that forger, We can deal with Chaim Bloch, the other great forger in the 20th century, Friedlander. I can deal with all the scoundrels of Jewish history also in the traditional world. But we have lots of Gedolei Yisrael we have to do before we get to the scoundrels. Yes, we're going to do the Rugachever. The Rugachever is coming up. Okay, how did he get to be so feisty? It was his nature. I'll talk more about that next class. Everywhere he went, there was Machlokas. There was Machlokas in Slutsk. I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to write about that, actually. He was involved in arguments wherever he went, and there are some people who it's just their nature. That's the only way I can explain it. We've seen plenty of examples of this in our time. Maybe some of the rabbis in your own community. I don't know what to say. It seemed to be his nature. He knew that he was great. Now, lots of rabbis know that they're great. But the Ritvaz, he didn't suffer fools kindly, and the problem perhaps was that he thought a lot of people were fools. But if you think that this is an issue with the Ritvaz, the Rugachever is 10 times more feisty and 10 times less respectful. At least the Ritvaz respected who he thought were his peers. Rugachever didn't respect anyone, not even the great Rabbi Yitzchak Inspector. He didn't respect. He literally respected none of his peers. So. We'll deal with that. Okay, I'll wait 2 more minutes. I see Yona's typing still. We only have 1 more class this semester. And we will not finish the Ritvaz. Yeah, the Ritvaz. The Ritvaz had a daughter who married convicts. I forget now about other children. None significant. But through his daughter-in-law, through his daughter, he has Rabbi Joseph Konvitz, who's one of the leading rabbis in America. He had other children, though. I believe the Tzitzel Yezer's wife is also descended from the Ritvaz, if I'm not mistaken. If we move, I'm asked if you can say Elliot. It doesn't have to be publicly. I've given class on Rabbi Weinberg. The very first semester, I gave on Rabbi Weinberg. I gave on Rav Cook too, but 2 of those 3 classes, there was problems with the tapes, so there's missing minutes, like in the Nixon tapes. I might do them over again, but I did 2 classes on Rabbi Weinberg on that. Rabbi Ipshitz and Ipshitz. We're working our way back, Elliot. We're in the 20th and 19th century. Eventually, we'll make our way to the 18th century. I don't know if you were here last semester. Well, we started talking about the Ralbag a bit, and I calculated that if we're still doing this in the year 2020, we'll make it to the 14th century, to the Ralbag. Yeah, Yona, that's true. We'll get to that. He was Chabad, so there's the Alter Rebbe and the Rambam. He never quoted the others, but we'll deal with the... I'll stay on 1 more minute. I see Yisrael. So Yisrael and Shmuley, those will be the last questions for today. Otherwise, you'll email it to me. I'll get to them.